If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
Hello and welcome to Borderlines, a Canadian immigration law podcast. I'm Stephen Murins. When and why did Canada develop the legal powers to detain and deport immigrants? This is the question asked by Simon Wallace, a PhD student at Osgoode Hall Law School and a former refugee lawyer, in his paper published in Queen's Law Journal titled, Police Authority is Necessary, The Canadian Origins of the Legal Powers to Detain and Deport, 1893-1902. Mr. Wallace joins us today to discuss the origins of Canadian deportation law and how the government endorsed immigration police powers when it appeared that Canada was the destination for thousands of Jewish Romanian refugees, as well as due to pressure from the Americans who were threatening to set up extensive border controls along the Canada-American border. A few weeks ago, Canadian members of Parliament unanimously appeared to demonstrate that they did not know the historical implications of what it meant for someone to have fought the Russians in World War II. The debacle was a reminder of the importance of studying history. I learned a lot listening to Simon during this episode and reading his paper, and I hope you come away with a greater appreciation of how Canada's deportation laws developed and evolved, its surprising connections to Jewish migrants, the use of seemingly neutral legislation to target a specific ethnicity, and private sector pushback to the emergence and requests of the Canadian government to begin deporting people. Once again, if you like this episode, please leave a review on iTunes, and I hope you enjoy.
When I started the PhD, one thing that I was curious about was like, why did I just do all that stuff? Like, why was I a deportation lawyer? Why was I a detention lawyer? And like, some of those questions just like engage personal things about me. But the other question is like, why do we have deportation law?
For sure. And it's interesting. Yeah.
And I tried to go find answers, and I found that very little had been written about it. So I went into the archives because I was a PhD student now.
Yeah, I have to say, I'm thinking about it more and more lately. And I think one of the things that Steve and I have been talking a lot about on the show is about the kind of immigration culture and how we've been seeing such fast evolution of our immigration culture. But at least my view, I don't know if you'll agree with this, Steve, is that I feel like we've fallen out of step with what exactly the unifying principle is of our immigration culture. So it's growing and growing, but I think that there's like, it's a bit of an octopus right now. And I feel like if you try to distill it down to some kind of basic principles, it would be very hard to do. And somehow this thing that you've written and this conversation piece about deportation, it's been very much on my mind too. One of the things, I just wanted to put this out there. One of the things that I think about all the time is when I'm dealing with refugee claimants, trying to explain to them that as the first step in their asylum process, they need to be receiving a removal order, and trying to explain how in this grand tradition of humanitarian resettlement and all of that, they're supposed to receive this piece of paper and not see it as a like, we don't want you, but just in case, we're going to go through this entire pantomime of a refugee hearing. And then if we agree, we'll rip it up. But still, like, again, it sort of, it really, I kept thinking about this as I was reading your paper. Like, where did this come from? Why is this the basis for our process? Like,
well, so that's, yeah, I mean, the study of history, part of what makes it fascinating is that when you practice law in the present or when you interact with the news in the present, you can kind of have built-in assumptions as how it works now is probably how it's always worked.
Of course.
And it's going back into history of how things came to be that you realize, A, that it often didn't used to be the same. In fact, it probably never was exactly the same as it is now. And B, that means that it is possible to have complete paradigm shifts as to how things work.
Yeah, exactly. Or at the very least, some examination of why we shifted to where we are and to like make sure that we are still on page with where we stand right now. Or is this just sort of a function of, you know, of the time has now happened and now we're just locked into where we are today? Like,
And then with what Simon's done in this paper, and obviously we're going to go through the paper and the narrative, is also like, I did that other deep dive history podcast on the order in council to ban Black immigration for a year. What is always fascinating to me about deep dives is how when we're reading, you know, history nuggets or news from, in this case, 120 years ago, without going through the deep dive, you can completely misconstrue what something was about. So in this case, and I was, you know, I fell to this too, and I would go back and read history, legislation, and history, you'd see, okay, they introduced legislation to ban, I can never know how to pronounce this, pauper, P-A-U-P-E-R, paupers, from entering Canada, which I took as, okay, this is just a neutral ban on poor people. But what Simon was able to, you know, identify and bring to life in his paper was that it was basically brought in and used to target Jewish Romanian refugees in particular. And that, I mean, I just find deep dives into history fascinating.
Mm-hmm. And that to me is the most interesting part, is we have an immigration law, which is like, it's always facially neutral, but every provision has a story behind it.
Mm-hmm.
We've sort of built this principled framework and rubric after the fact. But they're such discrete and idiosyncratic
for sure
that explain the shape of the law. And we've lost so much of that.
For sure. Well, something might evolve like as a kind of a carbuncle, you know, like we have this particular problem. We're going to create this legislation to deal with this particular incident. But then the carbuncle almost never gets lopped off. You know, it's sort of like what happened with ministerial instructions, you know, like, okay, well, this, we need to do this real quick and dirty. Okay, let's do this. And all of a sudden, there's a full erosion of the regulatory review process, you know, and that's just taken for granted that that's how it's going to be from now on.
And how a slight change can totally take on a life of its own. I can't remember who it was in your paper. I think it was a cabinet minister who, when they introduced one of the first laws to try to, you know, restrict who could enter Canada, was saying, well, it goes against everything who we are to try to restrict someone from entering the country to work. And, you know, flash forward 120 years, that's a cornerstone of our immigration policy, is we don't want people to come into work unless specifically authorized.
Yeah.
And how these little, you know, forks in the road can just completely branch into their own things.
Totally.
So why don't we set the stage with your paper, which was about, I guess it's a, to say the history of when Canada introduced the power to deport. One of the things that confused me a little bit in the paper, and maybe you can expand upon, was the relationship between the United States agents and Canada at this time, and why was it that people immigrating to the United States were arriving in Halifax in the first place? Because that was something I found a bit confusing.
Sure. So let me work to that question about Halifax and why people were going there. So for most of the 19th century, people from Europe, and it was different on the Pacific coast, but people who wanted to migrate from Europe to North America, either Canada or the United States, would just simply get on boats and come. Now we're used to the idea that people would be inspected and examined and have to get visas. And these are just new concepts, at least relative to the 19th century. What began to happen at the end of the 19th century is the Americans stepped up their own border policing initiatives. So particularly after the ban on Asian and Chinese migration on the Pacific coast, the Americans started to build up a police force to monitor migration, and then started to build their own inspection stations along the both Pacific coast and the Eastern Seaboard to inspect migrants, Ellis Island being the most famous example of this. At first, Canada didn't develop its own police force, its own inspection stations, because this was an American thing. So let's step back. You were asking about the American inspectors. So if you're traveling to North America, you can travel to any one of the cities along the Atlantic coast if you're coming from Europe. And some of those ships are going to be cheaper. Some are going to be more expensive. Sometimes it's easier to get to the western states by taking Canadian rail lines up over to Thunder Bay and going south. So migrants would have all sorts of reasons to choose one port over another. As Americans began to step up their own inspections in ports, there was a new reason added. You could go around the American inspectors. So go travel to Halifax. Who knows how many people were doing this, but the Americans thought everyone was doing it. Someone who you know, the Americans will never let you through. Well, let's just go to Halifax, so get over to Quebec City. Well, then we'll take the train over and we'll walk across into the United States, circumventing the American policing effort. And so what this story is kind of how the Americans became worried about that and began to apply more and more diplomatic pressure on the Canadians to build their own immigration police force, own inspection stations, to start enforcing a kind of continental immigration law.
So this wasn't something where it was organized, like there were trains from Halifax that would go straight to New York, organized by the U.S. government or something. It was just people would arrive. It was all like migration was done through private steamships, railways.
Yeah, and I mean, like, this is one of the leitmotifs, I think, of immigration law continuing today, is the role of private actors. And so, yeah, there were private Canadian, usually railway companies, but also steamship companies that were running trains just across the Canadian-American border. And there were no border crossings at that time. Mm-hmm. Like, Toronto, and you want to get to New York, you just go to New York. There's no one to stop you. There's no one to check your passport. And so it was good business. It was good business for a lot of Canadian corporations to facilitate the travel of migrants. And once the Americans became concerned about the travel of migrants, that began to be a threat to some Canadian corporate interests. And that was a tension law, making money and the interests of states.
It's almost like when you look at it this way, it's almost like the evolution of kind of an inverse colonialism, where it's like, now what's ours is ours. We're going to put boundaries around it and choose who gets to come in, as opposed to like the conquest component of colonialism, where it's like going out and finding new territories. But then, I mean, what's super interesting is how quickly then it starts to shift to like a social engineering model, where it's like, okay, now that we can control this, and I'm racing you through it too much, but this is some of what, like, even from very early in your paper, you're kind of you're anticipating, is that you know, the idea of the notional concept of deportation and border protection. I think when you talk about it from that level, in a sort of almost an abstract way, it really opens up a lot of very fascinating topics.
Yeah, like inadmissibility.
Yeah, exactly. For sure. Like when you're talking about, you know, different types of exclusion on the basis of poverty, on the basis of criminality. I mean, there are some of these undertones too in the paper as well that are super fascinating.
And like, it all begins with race, like particularly mm-hmm. the Pacific Coast, like the place where like immigration control and the ideas that continue to sort of animate much of immigration law really developed was on the Pacific Coast in the 1870s and the 1880s, when a number of white settlers became worried because of their racism and their anxiety about race, about the migration of Chinese workers into California and British Columbia. And this encouraged politicians, it encouraged working class movements, it encouraged all sorts of white groups to begin to define people to define an immigration status and say some people by virtue of their statuses are inadmissible and unwelcome. So it begins on the Pacific Coast with reference to race. And then interestingly on the Pacific Coast, on the Atlantic Coast, we get ideas about health, about disease, about pauperism, but almost always that's just sort of code again for race.
Right, of course.
And as all this is going on, and you talk about it in the paper, that as Canada is introducing its first deportation measures, as you note, on the Pacific, British Columbia had sought already to try to ban Chinese immigration. It was disallowed by the federal government. That in itself, the idea of a province trying to ban immigration nowadays would seem crazy. But it was also... Even if I knew, I guess, the timeline a little bit, it was interesting to note that, yeah, like the Chinese head tax is in force at this time, but there actually isn't a way to legally deport a Chinese person who doesn't pay the tax. Yeah. And that the idea of the just charging migrants more based on their race precedes any ability to actually remove migrants.
Yeah, I mean, that was the first puzzle that really attracted my attention, that when I went back and read the statutes, there are all these exclusionary measures. But as a lawyer, who was in detention centers, it's sort of like I was very alive to the fact that that modern immigration control is really premised on the idea that people can be detained and forcibly deported. Mm-hmm. And I expected to find those police powers in the anti-Chinese, anti-Asian laws in the 1880s. And they were there in the United States, but not in Canada. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of what I went looking for. It's like, well, where do they come from? And when were they developed? And what my main, contribution is to say that they came about towards the end of the 19th century the beginning of the 20th on the Atlantic coast. Deportations were happening surely before then. People were being deported from British Columbia, from all over the place, but it was always like ad hoc, questionable legality. Some people said they could do it, some people couldn't. So I was just curious, like, when did the government actually say, like, these are powers we have and we can use and we will? And so that's what took me back to the Atlantic coast.
I was really struck by this concept because it goes almost before all of these permutations and these questions and these problems, which is, you say, sometimes the power to deport was conceived as a statutory power, not a sovereign one. And I just found this just such a rich concept to kind of dig into. Where does this come from? How does this end up becoming part of the notion of statehood? And what is the instrument by which that is brought in? And so it's interesting that they were still happening informally, but this kind of this initiative to render it part of the legal code is very interesting from a conceptual standpoint.
Totally. And this just, I think, takes us back to the weirdness of doing historical work, you could imagine an alternate universe where the bureaucrats in Canada just woke up one day and said, we have the sovereign power to do this. So let's do it. We don't need statutory authority. But part of the reason that they were forced into this corner where they said, like, okay, we need to go get statutory authority is because those private actors I was talking about before. The private actors, initially the Canadian government kept going to them saying, like, will you deport this person? Will you do it? You don't let them. You're the one who brought them in. You're making money.
Right.
And they said, fine, show us the law. Show us the law. Until you show us the law, we're not going to do this. And it was because of the financial incentive of the private corporations not to assume the obligation of deporting people that Canada felt compelled to develop a statutory power to resolve that dispute between the state and corporate actors.
Wow. Well, so then that's one lever, let's say, the involvement of third-party actors, which then impacts on the evolution of the law. But the other one being by world events, which created different racial tensions and all of this kind of thing, I imagine, like, that also is the next huge thing. And these things are, like, still the two major factors that inform our policy. I love what you're saying about the fact that these rules are always facially neutral, but they're still always driven by these background factors. Like, who do we want in? Who do we not want in? How do we prevent that? You know, how do we go about it? How do we build a system to enable us to fulfill them?
Totally. And like the one event which really blew my mind in this piece is, so like I've described how the Americans were getting increasingly anxious about migration along the Atlantic coast, which was more often than not code for anxiety about Jewish migration. There was sort of a feeling that Jews were impoverished and bearers of disease, lots of the familiar anti-Semitic tropes that we all know and that were predicted.
They aren't farmers. That came through in your piece also, the notion back then.
Yeah, absolutely. And then there was this, and so the Americans actually lodged a formal diplomatic complaint with the imperial government in the United Kingdom, saying that Jewish charities were taking advantage of Canadian ports to circumvent American inspections. But then the event, which really just I find astonishing to think about now, is in 1899-1900 was the first year that Canada really flooded Europe with immigration brochures, immigration leaflets inviting farmers to come. At the same time, two volcanoes, Mount Etna and Mount Vesuvius, erupted. And one function of that eruption was that it clouded the skies over Europe, and the crops, particularly in the Balkans, failed that year. And scientists have gone back and they've looked at tree rings, and they've shown that because of these eruptions, there was just much less sunlight, much less precipitation. And in Romania, a country where anti-Semitism was rife, well, who got blamed? Who got scapegoated? It was the Jewish residents of Romania. And at the precise moment that anti-Semitism peaked during a recession, during an anxiety, that moment when Canada flooded Europe with brochures saying, come to Canada. And this instigated a huge movement of people. They called themselves the walkers, and they would walk to European ports to try to come to Canada. And this was the real event, the real moment. It was when the Canadian government learned that potentially thousands of Romanian Jewish refugees were bound for Canadian ports, bound for Canada, that they started to look really urgently for statutory power to be able to halt that migration.
Wow.
In neutral language.
The language they said is they drew on a long dormant statute that had never been used to say that the governor and council could ban pauper migrants. They're like, they knew. And they were sending telegraphs to all the companies. They're like, we're saying ban pauper migrants, but we all know who we're talking about.
You want to just define the term pauper?
Poor, yeah. And poverty. And so like they said, like they wrote to all the steamship companies and they said, like, yeah, like we're saying pauper, but just so you know, what we mean are Romanian Jews.
I love this quote. I think this is at the same timeline when you say parliamentarians were not enthusiastic about this law. And then I love the verbiage of how the member who introduced it was apparently embarrassed by it. I'd love to just read this little excerpt. Mr. Speaker, it is with considerable timidity that I rise to move the bill which I am going to ask the House to adopt. I quite readily understand that it is entirely contrary to the trend of modern legislation and to the ideas of the Canadian people to place any restriction upon laborers from any country entering the domain of Canada. So like, you know, this is us. We're super welcoming. However, and so.
Yeah. So that law is, that's just a slightly prior law.
Okay.
About functionally, it was retaliatory. Americans had put up the law saying that some, essentially saying some Canadians couldn't work in the United States. And so this was a member who was rising saying like, okay, we got to do something to respond. So like, let's pass this law, but we're all totally embarrassed by it.
Right. Yeah, for sure.
But then only a few months later, faced with the migration of Jewish refugees, well, no one's singing quite the same tune anymore.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that is just how these things come to erode, I find. That like at the beginning, it might seem super scandalous, we'll be shocked. I mean, I have to say, even with the, oh, international students are causing the housing crisis, you know, like it's the same sort of thing. Once it sort of enters, it might seem a little off. And then over the course of couple of months and a little bit, everyone sort of normalizes that concept and then we carry on.
Mm-hmm. And then also interesting how, like in both cases, how much of the conversation actually stays out of parliament, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And like there are these big issues, but they always sort of just get delegated to executives who will change a regulation here or do something there with massive, huge consequences, but kind of avoid the substantive debate. And that's, it kind of is astonishing to me that we have detention and deportation law in Canada, but there was never a day where MPs got together and said like, is this what we're going to do as a society? Yes or no. It just like, it just one day became a thing.
Yeah, they're doing it. So we probably need ours too, you know?
It's also interesting, like, yeah, now where people, you know, you have the private sector kind of pushing to try to test the laws. So there's this, could almost call it like a minimum threshold that is applied of this is how much money you have to bring. You note that I think there was one instance where it was apparent that the amount of money that Jewish Romanians were expected to have was greater than other people on the ship. But then it raised this whole question of, okay, well, now there's private organizations giving these people money. So how do you, you know, how do you interact with that? It almost reminds me a bit of when they talk about in the present day context of study permit applicants of, you know, large deposits in bank accounts and how that plays a role and just all these little origins of, you know, ongoing issues.
Mm-hmm.
Amazing the repeat patterns. Like one, I was doing some other historical research on security certificates. And like, so like when I was when I first started off as a lawyer, I thought I was clever. I was like, I'm going to do all these exciting things. And I remember there was this one time that I made this like legal argument about disclosure. And I said something like, we don't know what the minister's relying on. Maybe they don't like the fact that my, the fact of the color that my, the color of the t-shirt that my client was wearing one day. Go back. I find something from the 1970s. Another lawyer says almost the exact same thing, word for word, in a very similar case. And we're just like, all these processes are just inviting us to think in certain ways and say things in certain ways when we think we're being novel or
facing
situations. Yeah. Really not. Yeah. The system.
Yeah.
You know what else I found kind of ironic and funny almost in reading this was how when the Americans were sending their own inspectors to Halifax because there were concerns that Canada didn't have a strict enough immigration regime, the Canadian government was displeased about it, but couldn't do anything because we didn't have a strict immigration regime. Like it was this, there's just this funny irony in it.
What happened, like the Americans would come and so the Americans set up their own inspection stations in Canada. And that was the first step to satisfying the Americans. But then the Americans would reject someone, say you can't go to the United States. And they'd say, fine, I'll stay in Canada. And it, like at first, the Canadians said, great, because Canada was searching for more migrants at that time and struggling to compete with the United States for migrants.
Yeah.
But then after a while, it became something that caused anxiety in the with the government, that all the people were rejected by the American state in Canada. Meanwhile, the Americans just thought, like, we're rejecting people, but they're already on the continent. They're just going to cross the border at some point on their own.
In your readings, did you come across any suggestions that of politicians or anyone saying that the head tax that was at this time imposed on Chinese people should be extended to Jewish migrants as another way of addressing the issue that, that they didn't want these people coming?
I mean, it's kind of functionally what happened, without saying it like in the same sort of way, because how it finally did resolve this crisis where Romanian, this crisis in the view of the perspective of the government, where Romanian Jewish refugees did arrive, and Canada entered into negotiations with a number of charities to say, okay, well, we'll let these people stay, only these people on these ships, as long as you guarantee them. And the guarantee, I forget, I think it was $25 a person or something. I forget exactly what it was. But they, it's like in their mind, they just have the kind of head tax as a tool they can reach for. And they accepted guarantees sort of on the understanding that, well, we'll do this for a few hundred people, but we understand that it's just going to stop completely eventually. Mm-hmm.
Was there ever, like, as far as you could tell, a political debate? I mean, I know this wasn't debated in Parliament, to just extend the head tax to Jewish people? Or does that not appear to have been considered?
It doesn't show up in Parliament. And I mean, from the perspective of the anti-Semites in government, they were ultimately successful with stemming this particular migration. Very quickly, like, word did go back, and where hundreds of people had been arriving, it really slowed down. This wouldn't last. Soon there will be much larger migrations coming throughout the first few years of the 20th century. But at first they thought, well, like, we did it. Now that we have these powers to detain and deport people, and we've been able to convince the steamship companies that we'll use them and we'll be able to discriminate against some classes of migrants, they felt like they had been successful. The story of the next 10 years is like they quickly learned that it's going to take a lot more work to develop an immigration policy that can exclude people on explicitly on race-based terms and things like that. But just for a few months, they thought they had it.
Yeah, I think that I can't stop thinking about how the rhetoric, because as you say, the facially neutral rhetoric versus the actual qualitative and quantitative impact of the rules. And when you try and look at it from a constitutional standpoint, like if you're looking at trying to achieve substantive equality, like that, you know, that debate never actually happens. You know, I'm sort of muddling things together here because there's a lot going on in my mind, but the actual conversation about that society making, I feel like that's not happening at the political level. It's this rhetoric about, you know, what we need to do to stem controls, you know, that it's always done in this facially neutral way, the systems that are implemented, even though I think most people will be aware that it's going to have a direct impact on who's going to be able to get here and how. It's sort of the same thing when you think about it, this sort of shift to refugee resettlement from overseas, you know, how Canada's saying like, no, we're going to start focusing more on resettlement from abroad. Well, it does specifically determine who's going to be able to access it because of the barriers abroad to like accessing a UNHCR, these sorts of things. Again, seems facially neutral, but still it will have a direct impact on how many people are going to arrive. They can actually cap it by numbers. They're making it impossible to get here otherwise. You know, it's all that same sort of thing without there being this conversation about what is the ask, what is the give, like what is the decision about how we're going to want to do it.
I mean, I think the great question of modern immigration law. Like the IRPA today is just, it's patterned off of basically the 1911 kind of 1905 immigration acts, same concepts that there can be inspections, that they're inadmissibility, same sort of order, like the processes were spelled out. And when those acts were written, those were acts written in fairly explicit terms to support race-based immigration policing and race-based immigration policies. And these same concepts that were invented to support that type of politics continue today. And we haven't had that conversation. And I mean, one thing I think we can just learn is about how these apparently neutral regimes were actually set up to enable race-based exclusion, and probably are being used for the same ends today.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's why there's so much opposition to the introduction of artificial intelligence at visa office decision making, is because there is a mechanism being put into place. You know, unless people are doing this sort of type of work that you and Professor Rehag are doing, kind of looking at that data and being able to say facially neutral, but in effect, it is having this impact on certain regions and certain persons, you know, it's very hard to put two and two together and say this is the direct impact of making this substantive shift in the way that we, in the manner in which we select our newcomers.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Sorry, I was drinking water there.
Yeah, I mean, we don't have right now. I mean, you play the game of 100 years from now, depending on what the system looks then. How will people 100 years from now look back on a system where, you know, people with, I mean, then there's exceptions to this, but citizens of countries that are predominantly white don't need a visa to come to Canada, whereas those who, you know, are from some other countries, say where people are predominantly black, do need a visa. And there's justifications provided for that. I have no idea how it'll look 100 years from now. What's interesting also is that, I don't know if you saw that there's a class action that's been launched by prospective Afghan refugees who are alleging that the fact that, you know, Canada reached out to people from Ukraine and said, you can come, reached out to people from Hong Kong and said, you can come, and there's not the same program available to people from Afghanistan and other countries. And so the distinction, you know, 100 years ago would be if someone showed up at the border from, it would be like if someone from the border, for someone 100 years ago showed up at the border who was Ukrainian and was told, oh, come on in, come on in. And someone from Afghanistan was turned back. It's a little bit less visibly distinctive because, you know, we have, they're still abroad and they have to apply. But the effect is sort of the same.
Yeah, exactly. Like if you go back to some of the stories about boats that were turned away at the during the Second World War, I think that there's a more visceral reaction to that. But when you look at it in this context, that there's a visa, there's a CUAET for the Ukrainians, there's nothing for the Afghans who have to find their way to a UNHCR office, who knows where, you know, or I mean, not just you know, because I know Syria, you know, Ethiopia, again, all of these countries where like even just looking at the way that they might be landlocked and the actual difficulties of getting themselves somewhere where they're going to get recognition to be able to try and come to Canada, those barriers, it doesn't have the same visceral response because it's not a boat that got set back, you know, but at the same time, I think that we're creating this new phase of history. And I'm not sure that there's that same level of awareness that that's what's happening.
Yeah. And it, like what that made me think about is, I mean, what I find really interesting about this period, the 1890s, the early 20th century, is I think we see the first step in a process which is so familiar to us now, which is pushing out the border. And the Americans in the 1890s and early 1900s are doing their best to get other countries, Canada, to accept its logic of border control and border policing so that the Americans won't have to deal with their immigration problems within their own borders. It's
act of diplomacy as opposed to being something that we're doing to establish sovereignty.
Exactly. And so now we live 100 years from that moment where the pushing out the borders thing has just cascaded over and over and over and over again. And where in the 1870s, 1880s, there wasn't like an international law of citizenship. There is now. And there is now. Probably because the American hegemon sort of pushed that first domino. Yeah. And one of the first places it fell was in Pacific and Atlantic ports in Canada.
And then if you flash forward 100 years ago from, the U.S. pressuring us, Canada is working with the United States, complaining that Nigerians are getting access to the United States just to go up to Roxham Road. Mm-hmm. And there's this reversal of roles.
Well, it was the same. I mean, we should have recorded this on 9/11 within like the whole idea that terrorist attacks in the United States happened because of too much porosity in our border crossings and that they, you know, that the terrorists came from Canada, you know, and I think that there's always this discourse is not over that there's some kind of contributory negligence on behalf of Canada and not any recognition for the fact that this like adamant statehood is part of what causes the hostility in the first place, you know.
When does the Canada-US border start granting official ports of entry?
Yeah, so this was the big threat that the Americans were making in the 1890s and early 1900s. They were going to Canada and Canadian private transportation interests and saying, play ball, or else we're going to close the land border. And that was what ultimately got the Canadian government into the first few rooms was the Canadian transportation companies saying, like, we have to do everything we can to keep the land border open because our business is premised on the idea that we can help migrants into the United States and we can move people, that there's a free movement of people and goods across the border. And so the Americans kept coming back and saying, like, you're not playing ball. Should we close the border? And then the Canadians would say, well, no, we're playing ball. Finally, 1901, the Americans set up their first inspection stations along the border and begin to start inspecting some trains. It takes over a decade before there are inspection stations all along the border where that border is policed by immigration officers. But it begins in 1901. And there's this interesting moment in 1901 where Canada is about to pass this first major law to explicitly give the state the power to detain and deport people and force carriers to take them back. And then the Americans close the land border, and a bunch of the transportation companies come back to the government and say, let's not do this. Like, they've acted on their threat. Let's not institute our own immigration police powers anymore, because like, they've gone and done the thing, and immigration police powers are just going to disrupt our business further. So let's not do it. Ultimately, that wasn't a persuasive argument that they Some other companies were making the other argument, saying like, this is, it's more important for us to double down to make sure the Americans don't double down even further.
Right. Yeah. Well, it becomes a bit like a game of chicken in a way, you know, like, well, if you're going to do it this, I mean, this is how so much of this diplomatic stuff works. Like, you're going to give us a visa, we're going to give you a visa too. I mean, we've seen that repeating itself, this is what happened. Anyways, I don't need to give examples, but there are some in very recent history where there was like that. Actually with the Roma, where I think it was Hungary, and where was the second country? Anyways, we imposed a visa and then they did the same, and it was sort of like, yeah, check. But yeah, it's also like, I'm just hearing, you know, Donald Trump saying, you know, you do this or we're going to build a wall. And we think about this as being sort of, like just this idea that even if we do not create a wall, the imposition of visa requirements too, it's like, I guess this is what you're referring to when you're saying that we keep pushing out our boundaries. So the creation, our borders rather. So the creation of the physical border at the 49th parallel was one step. And then the idea of starting to actually police entries in advance of travel, the visa requirements and all of that. Do you have any sense of what the timeline was on that?
So there was a failed effort. So the around this time, the Americans paid for a doctor to go to Liverpool. The idea being that a doctor in Liverpool will inspect everyone before they board the ship, and like you can feel visa policy developing.
Right.
We were sort of invited to join that, and they didn't. The problem was, like, the Brits weren't willing to play ball either. So there was this doctor saying, you can't board the ship. And the British government would say, like, you're just a person. No. And let anyone board the ship. And we were not prepared to enforce the directions of this one American officer. So there's an equivalent story to be told about what's happening in particularly in Liverpool, but in a number of European ports at the same time, as the Americans are not, they're not just applying this pressure on Canada, but also on a bunch of European governments.
Right. And,
a bunch of European governments will soon, in the sort of years and decades to follow, implement very similar legislation.
Well, I think in your paper you talked about, was it the first deportation done under the new laws was of a Swede?
Yeah. So this was the exciting thing, is I found, I think, the first legal deportation. First deportation based off of statutory power. Like I said, there have definitely been deportations before, but there was this Swede, Hannu, who it was great. It was like a spy mystery almost. Coded messages from diplomatic channels that came to Canada saying, FYI, there's a Swedish mass murderer coming to Canada, and he said he's going to murder a bunch of people in Canada. And the Canadians moved to intercept him, quickly pass a law to be able to deport him. Eventually, like, they did. They prevented him from boarding and sent him back. Everything turned out to be a lie about this.
Wow.
Like, not everything, but he wasn't a mass murderer. He wasn't these things. There had been this view that had been percolating in Winnipeg in particular, that some of the Scandinavian countries had been making, that they often would sort of empty out prisons by sending people to Canada. No one was able to ever find real evidence of it. But once that coded telegraph comes saying, like, it's happening, there's this one guy, it would just sort of activate all these pre-existing anxieties. And because they had just activated some legislation to deter and stop the migration of Jewish refugees, they sort of knew how to do it for people who were deemed to be criminals.
Yeah.
So that was the interest. It was like, none of the Jewish refugees who made it to Canada, although they were detained aboard ship for a while, none of them actually ended up being deported because charities sort of stepped up and helped them. And so this was the guy who was first actually pursuant to legislation deported.
And when these first deportations are happening, I mean, you know, there's still an ongoing issue with when Canada tries to deport someone, some countries are more difficult about issuing travel documents. At this time, the countries that Canada and the United States were starting to deport to, how is this being received back in Europe?
Yeah, and so this is a tension which I think really leads to other countries developing their own concepts of citizenship and their own border controls. So at first, no one cares. Like, no one notices, really, you know? Yeah. Like, people have been moving in and out of ports all along. They don't recognize that someone is moving back because a country wouldn't receive them. Very soon, though, this becomes a concern. So it becomes a concern in a few places. So one was on the Canadian-American border, because the Americans started to deport people back to Canada. And they would write to Canada and say, FYI, we're deporting a Canadian. And then this would cause all sorts of consternation in the immigration bureaucracy here. Like, what is a Canadian? We don't have citizenship law. Should we accept them? They were only here for 2 months. Like, those sorts of questions forced Canada to begin to develop its own concept of citizenship. One of the most interesting examples I found is post 1904, 1905, Canada begins deporting more people back to India. And the British authorities in India were interested because they were concerned about political activism and who was being deported back to India. But they didn't have like a concept. There wasn't yet like a biometric system to be able to identify people. So this Bertillon system, the system which was invented where criminals would, like parts, they would be measured so they could later be identified. The British administrators in India wrote to Canada and said, we need you to get the Bertillon system so when you deport someone back, we can be sure we're getting the right deportees so we can monitor them for intelligence reasons. Wow. And so, yeah, your question was, what are other countries doing? At first, nothing, but then they notice it. And this in turn just leads to its own own response and incentivizes, encourages countries to develop their own border controls. And then, you know, it sort of just pushes out further and further and further. It sort of feels to me like the immigration system and deportation laws just sort of, it has its own momentum that only picks up, that has only picked up speed over a century. Like, once it's started, it's sort of hard to roll back for these dynamics.
Wow.
Well, yeah, once something's brought in, then it creates all new problems. Mm-hmm. Like, you were talking about how, you know, in England, there was a British person who had to enforce US immigration law. I was reading about how with the Chinese head tax, when there was an exemption for students, Canada didn't actually have anyone in southern China to check if someone was a student or not, and it fell on the British, who really didn't care. So they would just certify that people were students. And eventually you can see that giving rise to the need for visa offices, although I think that would come much later. I think in the interim they just banned Chinese immigration is a different solution. But and now it just, you know, if you look at the modern era, talking about this era where ships would just show up, to now you need biometrics, electronic travel authorizations,
visas. Sometimes UNHCR recognition, and then an invite letter, you know, like there's just so much stuff, more and more layers.
So interesting to see how like all those seeds existed in that moment.
Yeah,
like,
for sure.
Tried to have overseas medical inspection. It didn't work. They tried to do all these things and just sort of, there were ideas that were there that existed in some form at the origin and just took sometimes decades or almost a century to sort of fully blossom.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is, you know, this is why I keep saying, wow, I'm finding this whole thing very, like, very wow, because it's so pregnant with all of the different policies to follow that couldn't have even been contemplated at the time. But just the very basic concept of countries competing over those who are considered desirable and countries sort of playing hot potato with those who are considered undesirable. And this, you know, it doesn't exist prior to this period because the ability to make your way from various places to other places wasn't so significant. And as the mobility increased, it's like these two different games. No, we want him. No, we don't want him, started to really mobilize. And then it became what international global migration became. And again, whether or not we're having those conversations as a state building exercise as to what are these principles and what are these propositions and how do we wish to land on them? Or if it's just a matter of like, oh, we don't like this, let's do that. We don't want this, like this sort of patchwork, you know, this has become the new Canadian mosaic, this patchwork of like band-aids to like, nope, not them. Yes, them, you know? And that's what it feels like right now. Like, okay, now we've got a new exception for these H-1B holders. Now we've got this new prohibition on caregivers from abroad. You know, it's like, what are we doing? Like, what's the overall plan here?
Yeah. I mean, like lay my cards on the table. I don't think that there's ever been a moment where the law has been principled and makes sense. I think it's just always been.
That's true.
Little yeah. event has led to other little events, which are sort of accrete into this thing. And the like when we think of principles and rules and you know principles of statutory interpretation, this is just history. We've just forgotten the history and we just sort of.
Yeah, everything seems like it's new.
And also the what is going on, like it takes, I don't know what the, how many years it takes for these internal telegrams that you wrote about in your paper to become declassified or public. But it's also a reminder, like, I don't know how much the public back then would have known that the motivation and the implementation of these anti-pauper laws was directed at Romanian Jews. We kind of have hints now, like that Polaris report on immigration, where some people at IRCC are saying managers are saying racially disparaging things about certain client groups or applicant groups. But what is actually going on may take, you know, hundreds of years to, you know, decades for actual records to be released as to what was going on behind the scenes.
Yeah, and like as a historian, the historian in me is worried that we'll never really know because so much of correspondence ever now is by email. And it's one thing if you're an archivist to store telegrams and letters. How are you supposed to store the collective digital communication of the government of Canada?
Like, yeah, or the AI enforcement or the AI subject matter flags that are not even shared, even in the middle of litigation. How do we track all of those things when we're not even made aware of them?
Like an example that we talked about two, three episodes ago with the security screening. Like there's this, you know, theoretically neutral law that all immigrants go through security screening. What is the behind the scenes decision making going on with respect to people from China, Russia? You know, people are guessing at it. Will there be a time? Will it be decades? Will it be never that we learn kind of what was actually, what decisions were being made internally?
For sure. Yeah.
How do you get access to these old like archives? Is it just you physically having to go to the Library of Parliament? Is it?
So there. Library and Archives Canada has all the, they're called fonds, so all the boxes of materials from the immigration branch. Some of this I was fortunately able to do during COVID because they had a great program where they would scan some things for you. And then there's also an initiative put on by the CKRN, the Canadian Knowledge, I'll have to look it up, where they digitized millions and millions of pages of microfilm rolls, which are very tedious to navigate. But once you sort of learn how to navigate, if you learned how to navigate microfilm, you can figure out how to do it, navigate it digitally as well. So I was able to, through going to the archives a little bit when COVID allowed, getting them to scan some things and navigating the microfilm reels was able to explore all these sources.
But as you said, though, about the data as it stands today, the quantity of data is so incredibly overwhelming right now that, I mean, I used to regularly access the Canadian government statistics and use that sort of like those. But I find that even now, the way that they're organizing their data sets makes it almost entirely useless to me. It's sort of like you have to spend a lot of time and energy. Like Steve is really good at this, at being like, hey, this is something that makes sense and is important, and I'm going to add this new narrative to this to make people understand why this is important and relevant. Raj does a bunch of this as well on his Twitter feed. Like, here's the litigation. These are not just basic numbers, here's what you should associate with those numbers. But like, it's an incredible amount of effort unless you have started using some of these tools. Like, you know, you discussed, I think it was before we started recording, how you're using computer programming to actually abstract real information from those data sets in a way that is not set, because the way that they're set and the way that the narratives are put together and even just the search mechanisms makes it very, very difficult for the average person to kind of go in and ask a question and see the table, who's coming in, where, from where, when, you know, how, like all of this kind of stuff. So I think that that the level of sophistication of data analysts in order to look at current information is amazing, especially when you look at how difficult it would have been even to do that historically when things were more pen and paper. And
I don't see a contradiction between my historical work and my computational work. Like, at the end of the day, I think of myself as an empiricist, that if we're interested in understanding how systems function, not like in principle or in theory, but how they actually function, our goal needs to be to just collect as much data.
Right.
As much.
Yeah. Okay. That makes sense.
You work with Sean Rehag on that, or?
Yeah. Sean's my supervisor. So, yeah. And so like one method is historical. And I like to supplement my historical research with computational methods to just collect as much information as you can, because I think it's in building big models that sometimes we can see trends that our brains aren't wired to be able to see and understand.
Yeah. I'm curious, what was your, I don't know if you'll know the answer, you'll be able to come up with an easy answer to this, but what was your objective in writing this? Like, are you providing this empirical information just because of a matter of like academic curiosity? Is it because you're driven by a desire to create more transparency, to, you know, to induce policy reform? Like, what's the driver?
I mean, the first driver was just personal. Like I said, I was a lawyer in the detention center every day. It was like, why did I exist? Like, why is there a lawyer who does this work? And as I, like, there were a number of things that I saw while I was at the detention center that I wanted to sort of unpack when I stepped away from that. But that was one of the big questions. And then two, sort of a leitmotif of our conversation, but I think it's important for us to demystify immigration law, like if, particularly as lawyers. I think we get to, like, we invoke the charter here, the principle of whatever there, I just think it's like people who have come together and have had weird fights over legality in history. And what we're left with is the residue and the conclusions of their fights. And I think to tell that sort of legal history, where it's not about the grand elaboration of some principle, but to say, well, it was actually about how people wanted to protect racial power in a particular place, then it helps us piece together things. And the more we have a informed empirical analysis, the maybe it's the Freudian in me. It's like,
yeah, I get it.
This actually determines the shape of things, and the superego is just this little bit. So what we think is going on is actually determined by so many other things that we don't think about all the time.
Yeah.
And the more analysis we have of those things we don't think about, the more thoughtful we can be about everything we do.
It kind of reminds me of Professor Rehag's study around credibility. Is like, don't tell me that credibility is based on some like specific objective set of factors. Credibility is based on you didn't believe this person for whatever reason that might have been. You drew these such and such conclusions about them. And then at least be transparent about this is what the drivers were, as opposed to, you know, acting as if credibility is some neutral state that has these like very specific empirical markers that are the same for everyone.
We're all immigration lawyers here, so I'm sure we all had that same moment where we first read Hillary Evans Cameron's paper about the science of credibility and
totally
impossible. And yeah. It's funny, like when we think about how credibility is just something which no one can figure out, no one has figured out, yet we have a law.
I know. Like well, but it's so hilarious. Because I mean, the key component of credibility used to be contradiction. You know, like if you were going to contradict yourself, that made you non-credible. And then trauma theory came forward and was like, if you've been traumatized, your ability to construct a logical narrative will have been neurologically impaired. Now try again. You know, yeah. And it's like, okay, let's go back. It's because of the shiftiness of the eyes. Okay, so you know, and it's just. Like,
well, and it all takes place in a world where, you know, if people aren't going to share for studies or anything, like they're deep down what they really thought, if it's not, if they think it'll get them in trouble. So the whole process.
Yeah.
That's like a bit of a fiction. One question that I've been getting lately, and you'd be a good person to ask, is should I do an LLM? Hey, maybe I regret starting an LLM. I guess you didn't. So you skipped the LLM and went straight to a PhD?
Yeah, I'd done a master's before law school. So they
like, okay. So what, like, if someone is considering, I guess we'll skip LLM and just PhD in law. what are the factors they should consider?
Yeah. I'm very happy doing doctoral work. I'm happy because I did intense practice for a number of years, and it's nice to be able to step back from that. Ask, like, you know, when you're in practice and you're just like you're staring at the basketball so much so that you can see all the little things, but you forget that you're holding a basketball. Mm-hmm. So the doctoral work definitely lets you take a step back. It lets you like sleep at night, like particularly for me, like I used to get phone calls at like 1 or 2 in the morning to help set up bail plans and things like that. Let me tell you, there's no such thing as an academic emergency.
Yeah. Yeah. You're not waking up in the middle of the night thinking about a paper you've got to write.
No, that doesn't happen. For me at least, or preparing your submissions for court the next day. It's a very different pattern. But you know, there are real things to miss in practice. Like practice is fun. It's fun being on the ground and meeting court and meeting people. Life is quite solitary some of the time. And then it's not like there's a surplus of academic jobs at the end of the day. So on the one hand, that's like a good thing for lawyers to know, because lawyers, unlike people who go get PhDs in more traditional subjects, like their career options are limited. Lawyers can always be lawyers again. So like, it's sort of, you can think of graduate studies as something where you have a bit more of a fallback than many other people do.
How many years is it?
Well, isn't that the
question? Yeah. How long is a piece of string? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Anywhere from 3 years to 29. I mean, they begin to talk to you at year 29.
Wow. Fascinating.
This was a truly fascinating paper. It was very, very beautifully written as well, which made it extremely inviting. It really did help to kind of give a deep dive. You know, I'm not a history buff, I have to say, but I didn't feel like I was reading a history paper. I felt like I was reading something extremely current and like thought provoking and you know, so kudos. It was a really brilliant paper.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.